Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
I was proud to serve as your deputy on the National Security Council under President Reagan, and I'm proud to serve you here at the Department of State under President Bush.
John Negroponte is sworn in as ambassador to Iraq. As a series of coordinated attacks rock the country, we'll hear from Noam Chomsky.
So the big question then is whether the Pentagon will control Iraq after we transfer full sovereignty to them, or whether the proconsul, the modern proconsul, will run Iraq the way he ran Honduras.
Then, propping up the House of Saud, we'll speak with a prominent Saudi dissident.
Saudi Arabia has descended into a cauldron of hatreds and divisions. This has been exacerbated by the war in Iraq. All tribal, regional rivalries have been sharply exacerbated. And the royal family itself seems to be divided.
And the U.S. government opens its case in trial of Lynn Stewart.
Be off to court in another 15 minutes, there to confront the government with its lies and videotape, but no sex.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 70 people have died, 270 have been injured in Iraq after members of the Iraqi resistance staged a coordinated pre-dawn uprising in five cities and towns today. Most of the attacks targeted U.S.-backed Iraqi security forces. The worst violence was in the northern city of Mosul, where at least 40 people have died and at least 60 have been injured. Iraqis also died in attacks on Baghdad, Baquba, Ramadi, and Fallujah. In Fallujah, a U.S. Cobra helicopter was shot down. The U.S. bombed portions of Fallujah and Baquba. At least three U.S. soldiers also died today. The coordinated uprising comes less than a week before the scheduled so-called handover of power to Iraq. The attacks also come one day after Abu Musab al-Zarqawi vowed to assassinate Iraq's selected prime minister, Iyad Alawi. Zarqawi is a Jordanian who the U.S. claims has ties to al-Qaeda and is leading the Iraqi resistance. We go now to Baquba for a report from journalist Christian Parenti.
I'm in Baquba, which is a city to the east north of Baghdad, and there's been an uprising here. The Americans have been on an offensive for 4 days just south of Baquba, which is a mixed Shia-Sunni city, and they've been attacking the Shia part of the city. And now, today, there was an uprising here in Baquba, as well as in Fallujah, as well as in Ramadi and in Mosul. There were numerous car bombs in Mosul. There's fighting in Fallujah with many wounded. And here in Baquba, the city is sealed. Their U.S. troops have blocked all entrances in. I'm with the journalist Dahir Jamal and our translator, and we actually had to sort of sneak in on back roads. On our way in, U.S. troops shot at us from a Bradley. We were following a civilian minibus that was trying to get into the city as well. The entire city of Baquba is more or less deserted. What happened this morning at dawn was the Mujahideen, the local resistance fighters, distributed sort of warning pamphlets that the coalition forces were about to attack. And then the Mujahideen overran the police station, blew it up, and killed 21 police officers. And there has been sporadic firing all day and fighting and helicopter gunships on the, what is, I think, the south side of the town where the Shia are, that we've seen, and it looked like they were strafing. We also heard about six or seven extremely loud explosives, which a local person told us was actually just sound bombs used to disperse people. So that is the basic situation here in Baquba. We're now going to try and leave. And I also understand that the entire CPA, or Coalition Provisional Authority, in Baghdad was momentarily shut down. A colleague called me and told me that. They've shut down streets in Baghdad, but that's now relaxed somewhat. But there's clearly an uprising going on. in these four cities. And July is traditionally the month of revolutions in Iraq. It's when Qasim had his revolution on July 14th in 1958. The two Ba'athist coups or revolutions both happened in mid-July. So everyone is saying that this is sort of the beginning of perhaps some sort of July intifada as sovereignty approaches.
Journalist Christian Parenti in Bakuba, Iraq. The U.S. has given up trying to lobby the United Nations to exempt Americans from the International Criminal Court and prosecution of war crimes committed by U.S. troops overseas, including rape, torture, and other crimes against humanity. The U.S. had secured such an exemption over the past 2 years, but it faced wide opposition this year, in part due to the prison torture scandal. In Iraq, even though the UN will not be voting on the exemption, the U.S. has already received agreements from about 90 countries not to prosecute Americans. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the Bush administration has granted its own troops and personnel immunity from prosecution by Iraqi courts for killing Iraqis or destroying local property after June 30th. The Washington-based watchdog group Project on Government Oversight has sued Attorney General John Ashcroft for classifying previously public documents pertaining to the case of Sybil Edmonds. Edmonds is the former FBI translator who was hired after the 9/11 attacks. She's publicly said on Democracy Now! And other news programs the U.S. had information before September 11, 2001, that indicated al-Qaeda was planning an attack on the U.S. using planes. The government has been attempting to bar Edmonds from testifying in a lawsuit related to the 9/11 attacks. In addition to attempting to put a gag order on Edmonds, Ashcroft recently reclassified information that had been previously given to Congress in public. The suit filed yesterday claims Ashcroft's move to reclassify is illegal and unconstitutional. The Associated Press filed suit in federal court yesterday for full access to President Bush's military service records. The White House says it's released all the records related to Bush's service earlier this year. However, the administration has not responded to Freedom of Information Act requests for access to Bush's microfilm personnel file from the Texas State Library and Archive Commission in Austin. The records relate to Bush's service in the Texas Air National Guard. The period is surrounded by controversy because he was working for an Arizona Senate candidate at the time, and it's unclear whether he actually spent time in the Guard. In an incident similar to the beating of Rodney King, Los Angeles police officers have been captured on videotape beating a man after it appeared that he surrendered. The tape shows one officer kicked the man in the head, then hit him in the neck and upper back at least 11 times with a flashlight. The beating was filmed by a news helicopter. The incident began when the man attempted to flee police on foot. He was unarmed. Civil rights activist Naji Ali said, quote, "Here we go again. This is Rodney King all over again." Los Angeles Police Chief William Bratton said, quote, "There is no denying it looks very bad from what's seen on the video." Bratton said the incident would be investigated. Newsweek is reporting John Kerry has narrowed his list of possible vice presidents to three: Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa, former House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt, and Senator John Edwards. Ralph Nader took the unusual step of urging his opponent to select Edwards, the former trial lawyer. In other election news, Congressional Black Caucus has met with Nader and requested he drop out of the presidential race. Meanwhile, in Arizona, the Democratic Party has filed suit to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot. The suit challenges the validity of petitions submitted by Ralph Nader's campaign. And supporters of jailed soldier Camilo Mejia rallied in Lawton, Oklahoma yesterday, where the military held a hearing to determine if Mejia should receive conscientious objector status. Mejia was sentenced last week to 1 year in prison for desertion. He refused to return to Iraq last year, in part because he said he witnessed U.S. soldiers torturing Iraqis. Among those protesting outside the hearing was Nancy Lessen, co-founder of Military Families Speak Out.
Soldiers have the right, under our laws, to become conscientious objectors. Some of those soldiers become conscientious objectors in the heat of battle. That is when they realize that what they're doing is wrong. What Camilo Mejia did by refusing to go back to war was exercising the rights he has under the law. He does not belong in prison. He belongs free, and we should all be supporting his courage of conscience.
That was Nancy Lessen, Military Family Speak Out, thanks to independent reporter Scott Gurian, who covered this protest. Again, Camilo Mejia has offered to testify before Congress about what he witnessed in Iraq, particularly around the torture of Iraqi prisoners. Instead, he was court-martialed. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the costs of the war in Iraq, again, the latest news, at least 70 people dead, over 270 injured in Iraq, as the Iraqi resistance stages a coordinated pre-dawn uprising in five cities and towns today. Most of the attacks targeted U.S.-backed Iraqi security forces, the worst violence in the northern city of Mosul. The Institute for Policy Studies in Washington has just come out with a report called Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. We're joined now by IPS fellow Phyllis Bennis. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Amy.
Can you lay out these costs?
We've been very concerned that we're paying such a high price for failure in Iraq. More and more people, I think, are becoming aware of the number of U.S. troops that have been killed. The body count is the one number that remains high in American consciousness. We know that as of 2 days ago when we issued the report, the number of U.S. soldiers dead was already 853. It's now higher than that. There's been more every day. But other costs are not as clearly known. So, for example, the cost in Iraqi lives is not commonly known. The fact that more than 10 times as many Iraqi civilians as U.S. soldiers have been killed is not widely known. That body count ranges, the estimates are difficult to pin down, but the lowest estimate is 9,436 Iraqis killed in that same period. People in this country get access to very little information about, for example, the monetary cost of the war, which so far, just to us in this country, has been over $151 billion. And as a result, we don't think very much about what other things that money could be used for. The $151 billion that we've spent just this year on war and occupation in Iraq could pay, for example, for health care for 27 million uninsured Americans. It could buy 678,000 fire trucks in cities whose fire departments have been decimated. It could put 20 million children into Head Start. So it's a huge economic cost. Every household in this country will pay, on average, $3,415 each over the next 3 years for U.S. occupation in Iraq. The costs are staggering. And what we did was to look not only at the economic costs and the human costs, but also to broaden our definition. So we looked at the environmental costs. We looked at the human rights costs. We looked at the security costs. We're being told, for instance, the Bush administration tells us all the time, that war in Iraq is making us safer. Well, in fact, according to the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, which is perhaps the most prestigious and influential military institute in Europe or the U.S., when they were asked for a quick answer to the question, what is the effect on Al-Qaeda of the war in Iraq, their answer was accelerated recruitment. This war is not making us safer. It's putting us at much greater risk all around the world. The question becomes, what is the Iraqi response? Iraqis are clearly paying the highest price in economic terms, in human terms, of course, in environmental terms over the long haul, in terms of social and political indicators, the loss of sovereignty only being the most obvious. Iraqis were asked in a study just about 2 weeks ago, conducted by the U.S. occupation authorities, their views about the occupation. The percentage of Iraqis who expressed, quote, no confidence in either the U.S. occupation authorities, the civilian authorities, or in the coalition forces was 80%. The percentage of Iraqis who said they would feel safer if all U.S. troops left today is 55%. So this claim that somehow the transfer of sovereignty, what is being called the transfer of sovereignty, sometimes they try to say transfer of limited sovereignty, essentially the equivalent of being a little bit pregnant, you can be a little bit sovereign, that somehow this is going to answer the problem of Iraqi opposition to the U.S. occupation, was put to rest today, clearly, in this massive escalation, this new set of attacks in five different cities, leaving at least 70 people dead, virtually all of them Iraqis. And in that context, it's clear that the new target for the Iraqi opposition is going to remain the people seen, accurately or not, as collaborating with the United States. The tragedy, of course, is that of the people killed, not all of them are collaborators. There are collaborators. They are not the only victims. But all the victims are Iraqi. So the price that's being paid is being paid on a daily basis, and it's mounting. I think that when we look at the numbers, I mean, our report goes on for 58 pages of documented statistics and numbers of the costs in the to the environment, the costs to political legitimacy, the costs to human rights. The human rights costs have been horrific. If we look at the global costs, for instance, to human rights, the war in Iraq, particularly, although not only, the escalation of human rights violations and torture at Abu Ghraib prisons and the other prisons run by the U.S. occupation forces has given a green light to human rights violations all around the world. It's legitimized for many governments allied with the United States the right to abandon even the claim to be abiding by the Geneva Conventions, by other human rights instruments, because they can point to the U.S., they can point to not only the practice of lower-ranking U.S. military officials at Abu Ghraib in carrying out this torture, but they can point to the memos written by the highest levels of the Bush administration who talk about the need to abandon the Geneva Conventions as quaint, claiming that President Bush, as commander-in-chief, has executive authority to ignore all conventions that the United States has signed on to determine that no soldiers perhaps may be automatically entitled to Geneva Convention protections. And despite all of President Bush's very defensive posture regarding, I never authorized torture. We have to look at that in the context of the definition that his administration has had of torture. They define torture only as mistreatment that is so serious as to cause pain, the equivalent of death or the destruction of major organs. Now, if you take that as your definition of torture, I'm sure he didn't order torture. The problem is that's not the definition in the global understanding of torture as represented in the International Convention Against Torture, which has a much, much broader definition of torture, so, which the Bush administration appears not to even accept. So the cost globally to human rights is a huge cost of this war.
Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. The report out today is called Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. The website, Phyllis.
The website is at www.ips-dc.org.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Following a recent spate of attacks against U.S. citizens and corporations in Saudi Arabia, the kingdom announced a limited amnesty offer yesterday to militants who turn themselves in within the next month. Those who've never taken part in attacks apparently won't be prosecuted. The announcement came in an address by Crown Prince Abdullah broadcast over Saudi Arabia and the Arab world. He said the government is offering a chance for militants to, quote, repent, plead guilty, and voluntarily surrender. Prince Abdullah added that those who did not would, quote, face a resolute force. Over the past 2 months, Saudi Arabia has become a major front line of resistance against the U.S. presence in the region. Last week, Lockheed Martin employee Paul Johnson was beheaded in statements broadcast on an al-Qaeda website claimed that sympathizers within the Saudi military helped facilitate his kidnapping. Johnson worked on Lockheed's production of Apache helicopters. He was one of three U.S. contractors killed in Saudi Arabia over the last 2 weeks. Over the past year, militants have also targeted U.S. companies like the Vinnell Corporation, a private military firm which trains the feared Saudi National Guard. Last May, a triple car bombing in Saudi Arabia killed 34 people, including 8 Americans, at a housing complex used by Vinnell. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda has appointed a former Saudi security officer named Salah Mohammed al-Houthi to head the organization in the kingdom following the killing of Abdulaziz al-Mukrin last Friday. A cousin of the new al-Qaeda leader was allegedly one of the September 19th hijackers. September 11th hijackers, one of the 19 of them. But as our next guest writes, quote, it would be wrong to predict any immediate collapse of the state. Despite a marked cooling in relations, Saudi Arabia remains the key ally of the U.S. in the region. With continuing violence in Iraq, Washington's priority is to prevent Saudi Arabia descending into similar anarchy, even if it means propping up a regime it no longer likes or trusts. While oil prices remain exceptionally high, and with a U.S. presidential election in November, Saudi Arabia is the pump that cannot be allowed to run dry. Those are the words of May Yamani in an article published in The Guardian entitled, Washington Will Prop Up the House of Saud for Now. May Yamani is an associate fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs and author of the forthcoming book, Cradle of Islam, The Hijazi Quest for an Arabian Identity. Her previous books include Feminism and Islam. She is the daughter of the former Saudi oil minister, Ahmed Zaki Yamani. May Yamani joins us on the line from London, from the studio at Chatham House. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off by talking about the beheading that took place of Paul Johnson and the allegation that some in the Saudi security forces helped to facilitate his capture.
Well, the beheading is part of a series of horrendous acts and an increase of violence in Saudi Arabia that we have been seeing in the last year. And we have to look at the fact that one, Al-Qaeda itself is homegrown Saudi. Its ideology, support, and recruits are from Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden, born in Saudi Arabia, fights in Afghanistan, but seems to send his, and he sent his ideological children back to his homeland. So the possibility of collusion between the security forces and these violent jihadis or terrorists is based on the fact that there are familial tribal links between some of those working in the security and their cousins. And we see now the appointment of this Al-Awfi, who was an ex-policeman, and although he did not have any experience of jihad in Afghanistan, but as he is related to the terrorists. The whole thing is infiltrated. And the problem at the moment is not only that the royal family, who turned a blind eye for a very long time and even supported these radical Islamists or Salafis, now is a time when they see that it is too late. They realize that they don't know who is the enemy and who is the friend. The situation got out of control.
We're talking to May Yamani, who is banned from working in Saudi Arabia in Britain now, but follows closely what is going on in Saudi Arabia. Much of what we hear about the claims of responsibility, for example, appear on websites. You've written about the Islamic websites and their use by various groups. You recently wrote a piece called fatwas.com. Can you talk
Yes.
about this?
Well, what happened is there is no central authority in Islam, in the Islamic world today. You have Muslim states, be they Iran and the Shia in Iran or the Wahhabi state in Saudi Arabia. They have attempted to control. If we focus on Saudi Arabia now, it is a coalition government. You have the Al Saud and their alliance with the Wahhabis, and they have tried to control and to have their own version of Islam. At the moment, it has been hijacked. there's no more role for Mecca or for a central role or an acceptance of pluralism. What has happened is the fatwas online reflect the dissatisfaction, the anger of so many young Muslims, and specifically the Muslims from Saudi Arabia, against their regimes that are not, that is not satisfying their needs. And they attempt to have their own version of Islam, and some of it is very violent. I think the most important thing that we're looking at now is that there are going to be religious wars within Saudi Arabia between different, because the Wahhabi religious establishment itself is fragmenting with different groups, because the Shia-Sunni problem has been exacerbated, and the Shia are considered heretics by the Wahhabi Sunni establishment. We are seeing like a religious war, a looming religious war between all these factions, and you can see them with the many fatwas online.
You write, all Saudi Shia are followers of the Iraqi Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, so they already look across the border for guidance. You write, bearded, turbaned, and cloaked Shia clerics, now far more visible in Iraq, terrify the minority Saudi Wahhabis. Can you talk more about that?
Indeed, for many, many years from the beginning of the establishment of the state, the Shia in Saudi Arabia have been discriminated against. They are not allowed to be part of the government or the diplomatic corps or even teach history in schools. And since the 80s, they were not even allowed to operate the oil installations like they used to do. What is happening is that the Shia have become emboldened after the collapse of the Saddam Hussein regime, and they have gone to Crown Prince Abdullah and demanded more rights. What is more important is to recognize that the balance of power within the Middle East, the religious Shia are going to be more powerful than when they used to be a minority. In other words, from Iran to the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, that is the oil-rich province, to the southern Iraq, this is a petrolistan. It is like an accident of geography that the most richest oil areas are under the Shia. The majority are the Shia, and I think the Shia are not going to lose this opportunity in history to show their political weight and economic clout. This will create tensions for the Saudi regime, because it is in direct clash to its state ideology, the Sunni Wahhabi. So are we in also for changes in the balance of power in the region? And this is a worrying thing for the regime in Saudi Arabia. And the borders are open, with jihadis going into Iraq. And we know that they are there in Fallujah, Saudi jihadis, and the other way, arms coming in from Iraq, very cheap, despite the attempt of the control of the Ministry of Interior.
We're talking to May Yamani, speaking to us from Britain, from Chatham House, from a studio. The most often seen Saudi spokesperson here in this country on the many talk shows and the Beltway is Adel al-Jabbar, who is identified as the foreign policy advisor, the Saudi foreign policy advisor. Can you talk about him and what he represents?
I think that the Saudi rulers have, both from within the royal family and others who work for them, a very educated and eloquent elite. who are trying to convince the world and perhaps themselves that things are under control in Saudi Arabia. Now, it's becoming more and more difficult to explain the very ambiguous situation and the increase in violence and the dubious relationship also with the United States. So the task is more difficult, and I think what is more important here is how do they explain when the king and the crown prince Abdullah are offering amnesty to sympathizers, let's say not those who are the killers, but sympathizers with the jihadi terrorists today, how do they explain that the moderate, liberal, educated men have been put in jail, arrested and put in jail since last March? Why don't they offer them amnesty? There is so much more to explain in this situation.
We're talking to May Yamani in Britain. What about these gun battles we hear about in Saudi Arabia when they say there's a gun battle here and there? Overall, about the issue of how stable is the Saudi regime right now and who's engaged in these gun battles?
There are so many gun battles that are not reported. There is so much siege and there are thousands of new security men brought out from the tribes. I don't know how well they're trained. We don't know what is their connection with other jihadis. It is certainly not a question of revolution now in Saudi Arabia, nor is it a question of an immediate collapse of the state, but all the signs of a failing state, failure of the state of Saudi Arabia to integrate its people, to use the moderates, to use the educated middle class, to try to bring the people from the different regions and who feel themselves to be marginalized. We're looking at a very difficult situation. It is perhaps too late. But maybe if we want to look at a window of hope, if they still can use some of the moderate elements and embark on real, genuine reform, not only the talk of reform and the window dressing and cosmetic changes that they have been promising.
Hey, May Yamani, why are you banned from Saudi Arabia?
I would like to correct this. I am not banned from going to Saudi Arabia. In fact, I think they really would very much like to have me in Saudi Arabia so that I would be silenced. That is the problem. Many of my colleagues who wrote and spoke and lectured in Saudi Arabia are still in jail. And the question here is, why is there no liberal opposition in the country? The question is, they allow so many, and we go back to the website, of very violent language, and some of their neo-Wahhabi guys, and they allow them to keep their websites, but they are, it seems, more frightened from the liberal moderates in the country. I'm just simply an academic. I analyze and I write what I see. If I see reforms, I would write it, but I am not going to be silenced or attempts to intimidate me or to tell me they'll put me in jail. So I remain here.
What about your father's role today as the former oil minister of Saudi Arabia?
I do not think we should mix my independent work as an academic and my writing with my father's political role.
Though
there is no connection between the two. I work entirely independently and I write according to what I see.
And in terms of comparing the human rights records of the Saddam Hussein regime, of Saddam Hussein, and the Saudi regime, how would you say the Saudis compare?
I really don't think that the Saudis would compare to the atrocities of Saddam Hussein's regime. I think that the Saudi human rights abuses and the record is appalling, but certainly not to the level of crimes committed under the Saddam Hussein regime. And I speak from experience as half Iraqi and knowing of, you know, through relatives and family there. There is no comparison, except that the Al Saud remain in denial and are not doing anything yet to reform the judiciary, to look at the corruption in the country, and also to do something about the role of women in the country and their rights.
Well, I look forward to having you back on to talk about the role of women in Saudi Arabia. May Yamani, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, John Negroponte is sworn in as ambassador to Iraq. We'll get comment from Noam Chomsky. And then Lynn Stewart joins us on her way to the courthouse where she's being tried by the U.S. government. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. John Negroponte was sworn in as the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq on Wednesday. Negroponte is due to arrive in Baghdad at the beginning of July, soon after the so-called transfer of sovereignty. He'll preside over the largest U.S. embassy in the world, manned by 3,000 employees fortified within the Green Zone. Baghdad will be his fifth post, including his most recent assignment as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The Senate approved Negroponte to the Iraq appointment in record time, holding his confirmation hearing just 8 days after he was nominated and approving him soon after. After being sworn in on Wednesday, John Negroponte addressed Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Mr. Secretary, I also want to thank you for your unstinting support over the years. I was proud to serve as your deputy on the National Security Council under President Reagan, and I'm proud to serve you here at the Department of State under President Bush.
At the ceremony, Secretary of State Colin Powell called John Negroponte a, quote, pillar of confidence and courage. But his record as ambassador to Honduras tells a different story. From 1981 to 1985, he earned a reputation for supporting widespread human rights abuses and campaigns of terror in Honduras. As ambassador, John Negroponte played a key role making Honduras the launching ground for the Contra War in next-door Nicaragua. Days after President Bush appointed Negroponte to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, MIT linguistics professor Noam Chomsky spoke about Negroponte at the Cambridge Forum. He began by referring to a Washington Post article from late April.
The subheading, it says, Negroponte has tricky mission. And then the subheading is modern proconsul. Okay. And it begins by saying that as the ambassador to Honduras in the 80s, Negroponte was known as the proconsul, a title given to powerful administrators in colonial times. And now he's been chosen to take up that same role in Iraq, assuming, there's one problem, assuming that the Pentagon is willing to cede its control. So the big question then is whether the Pentagon will control Iraq after we transfer full sovereignty to them, or whether the proconsul, the modern proconsul, will run Iraq the way he ran Honduras. I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but a day or two after Negroponte's appointment was announced, the government of Honduras withdrew its forces from Iraq. Not many, you know, a couple of dozen, I guess, but might have been a coincidence. Or maybe they remember something from what happened there, the kinds of things that Amy was telling you about. He did have a job. He had quite an embassy there, not the size of the one he's going to be running in Iraq, but in Honduras, which, as you know, is a kind of centerpiece of world power. He had a huge embassy with 1,000 people. He had a huge embassy. He ran one of the biggest embassies in the country, in the world, and he also had the biggest CIA station in the world in Honduras. Obviously, terribly important place for the CIA to concentrate. And he had two jobs there, the article explains. One was to ensure that Congress didn't get upset about the fact that the Honduran security forces were carrying out tortures and massacres. It's famous Battalion 316 that Amy was talking about. He had to deny those so that the military aid would keep coming for him to be able to carry out his major task, which was, of course, supervising the Contra camps in Honduras, from which the CIA mercenary army was attacking Nicaragua. Not a small affair. The death toll in Nicaragua from the U.S. terrorist war based in Honduras per capita, relative to population, would be the same as about 2.5 million dead in the United States, which turns out to be higher than the total number of American deaths in all wars in U.S. history, including the Civil War. So from the Nicaraguan point of view, this was not a small event. It did lead to establishing democracy with a gun at their heads after Bush warned them that this is going to go on unless they vote for our candidate. This is Bush number one. Nicaraguans voted for the U.S. candidate, were rewarded for that by, there was tremendous applause in the United States. The New York Times had big headlines saying Americans united in joy. Kind of like North Koreans. Americans united in joy at the victory for U.S. fair play. Yeah, that's pretty much what happened. Since then, since the U.S. took it over again, Nicaragua's declined to the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti. Again, by accident, Haiti happens to be the main target of U.S. military intervention in the 20th century. Nicaragua's second, but that's just another coincidence. About 60% of Nicaraguan children under two are now suffering from severe anemia from malnutrition, meaning probable permanent brain damage. About half the active labor force is out of the country because there's no way to survive there. But it is regularly described in the Wall Street Journal, too, as an economic miracle where you can buy anything you want, which is true. There are 24-hour malls open for people who can afford it. And you can buy computers and plenty of great great place for retired Americans to go. They can live very cheaply in wonderful mansions and so on. But for children under two, the prospects are permanent brain damage. And that's what we call a victory for democracy. So that tells you something about the Bush's messianic vision to bring democracy to Iraq using the same experienced official, and we can don't have to go on about the kind of democracy that he brought to Honduras or that the present incumbents in their Reaganite phase brought to the rest of Central America. But that we're supposed to forget about.
Noam Chomsky speaking in the Cambridge Forum in Massachusetts about the record of John Negroponte. He has just been sworn in as the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, presiding over the largest U.S. embassy in the world. 81 to 85, he presided over the largest CIA station in the world in Honduras. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to a story closer to home here, close to the firehouse, because it's taking place right at the courthouse down the road. Demon beasts behead again. That's the banner headline stretching across two pages of the New York Post. Underneath, there were three photos. Suspected al-Qaeda leader Abu Zarqawi, masked Iraqi gunmen preparing to behead Kim Sun-il of South Korea, and New York civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart. Next to Stewart's photo reads another headline. Evil Sheikh's jihad lawyer poses threat worldwide. Feds charge. Besides these pages of the New York Post, Lynn Stewart has never been connected to the Iraqi resistance, but she's at the center of one of the country's most watched trials connected to the so-called war on terror. On Tuesday, the government's trial against Stewart began in the same New York federal courthouse where the Rosenbergs were tried for espionage more than half a century ago. The government's accusing Stewart of being part of an international conspiracy to provide support to terrorists, to conspiring to defraud the United States, and making false statements. Stewart is being tried with two co-defendants, the Arabic translator Mohammed Yusri and a Staten Island resident, Ahmed Abdel Sattar. But so far, the focus of the trial has been less on any of the defendants, but a man already in jail, the Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh, who is serving a life sentence on terror-related charges. While he's still in jail, the government is accusing the Sheikh's attorney, Lynn Stewart, and her two co-defendants of essentially carrying out a jailbreak, not by freeing the Sheikh, but by freeing his messages from his jail cell. The government claims the three conspired to sneak messages into the Sheikh and then to sneak his words out. Most notably, the government claims the three conspired to release a press release announcing that the Sheikh no longer supported a ceasefire in 2000 between the militant Islamic group and the Egyptian government. Federal prosecutor Christopher Marvillo told jurors on Tuesday, quote, his words and speeches were as dangerous as weapons. The government's case appears to be largely built on audio and videotapes secretly recorded of meetings between Lynn Stewart and her client, as well as the home phone of Ahmed Abdel Sattar. The government is also charging Stewart with making false statements because she reneged on her agreement, they say, to abide to what is known as SAMs, special administration measures, that were put in place by the government to keep the blind Sheikh in isolation. Under the terms of the SAMs, Stewart was prohibited from passing on messages of the blind Sheikh. Lynn Stewart is being defended by the acclaimed attorney Michael Tiger, best known for representing Terry Nichols during the Oklahoma City bombing case. Tiger told jurors Tuesday, quote, Lynn Stewart would not issue anything she thought was a terrorist message or a call to arms. Lynn Stewart is a compassionate, skilled, and brave lawyer, he said. Well, Lynn Stewart joins us in the studio now on the way to the courthouse. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Glad to be here as always.
Well, it's quite something to see these pictures arrayed in the New York Post from the masked men behind the young South Korean man who is beheaded, and then the picture of you.
It's so over the top that even those persons who would otherwise be moderate, I mean, people like the courtroom sketchers and people who are basically there out of curiosity said, did you see the post? Isn't that awful? But it's part of the media press also to characterize this case in the way the government wants to characterize it, and that is that the T word, first and foremost, as I'm fond of saying, the Rosenbergs in that very courtroom were smeared by the C word many, many years ago, the communists who gave the secret of the atomic bomb. Now they're trying to smear us with the T word, the terrorist lawyer who aided the Middle East insurgencies.
Federal prosecutor Christopher Morello said in his opening.
It's actually Morvillo.
Morvillo said in his opening. What is this case about? Quite simply, he said, this is a case about a jailbreak, not your typical jailbreak where a prisoner is freed to once again walk the streets. It's a different type of jailbreak, but one that the evidence will show was equally as dangerous. The idea that you took the Sheikh's message out, despite having signed these special administration measures saying that you would not do that.
Well, I think that what you have to start with is at the very beginning, and that is the question of who decides what is dangerous and what is not dangerous, and who makes the decisions to completely. He also said in that opening, we locked him up and threw away the key. Well, I'm sorry, in America, we don't throw away the key. The key is always the lawyer who defends someone who is locked away in jail. I was not about, nor was Ramsey Clark about, to allow the government to substitute their assessment of our client for our own. Once we allow the government to define the people we're defending, it's a slippery slope downward to the government will just no longer need lawyers, no longer need defenses, no longer need any kind of court proceeding, because they will decide in advance who is guilty and who is not.
What about the recordings that they say they have? For example, you saying that you're a good actor, that you should win an award for acting.
You know, I don't know how many people have had jail visits, but in jail, it is always a problem that the guards like to listen in. They're sitting there, they're bored out of their minds, so they listen to what the lawyer is saying to the defendant. Sometimes it's innocuous, sometimes they're doing it for real. We are always making efforts to make sure they're not overhearing us. Why? Not because anything's going on that's secret or clandestine, but because we have a right to a private conversation, whether we're discussing the Sheikh's daughter and her prospects for marriage, or whether we're discussing whether we should bring a conditions lawsuit, whether we're discussing what the guards did to him a week ago. Whatever it is, we had a right to privacy. So I always like to say, yes, I was distracting the guards from listening in to what they weren't supposed to be listening into in the first place. So first things first, the real problem there was they were listening in. They don't have a right to listen in.
Right now, the scene in the courtroom, can you describe it? Our producer, Mike Burke, was there. The courtroom packed, the overflow room packed, where you could look at what was happening inside.
It's interesting. A young disabled fellow who I met in Brooklyn when I was speaking there wrote a poem saying, the courtroom's packed with the most diverse group. It looked like the UN had emptied out and come down to Foley Square. And he said, if Jews and Muslims can get together to back Lynn Stewart, maybe we should send her out to make some world peace, because she must have the right message. It really was a tremendous outpouring. We hope we can keep it up. This is going to be a six-month trial. We have a wonderful jury, we think, of independent, mostly Manhattanites, who can stand up, can withstand the government's onslaught here.
Well, we'll continue to file this, and we invite you back into our studio. Lynn Stewart, thanks for joining us on her way to the courthouse today. The case against her, the trial, has opened. That does it for today's program. I'm looking forward to seeing folks in Los Angeles tomorrow at the Long Beach Convention Center, the Universalist Unitarians, at noon and 1, and then at 6 o'clock at 2,000-plus bookstore in Los Angeles. On Sunday morning in Orlando, Florida, American Library Association, Sunday night celebrating KKFI in Kansas City. Democracy Now! Produced by Shufa Bdokadus, Mike Burke, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.